Good evening. James McKenna here with my Science Hour, May 7th, 2020. A lot of topics to cover tonight. I'll be talking about some space science issues in my main science topic tonight from a listener that called in. I'll just give you a preview. So I'm going to give a few comments about some other issues that are necessary for you to understand. But the listener called in, emailed in, and asked about water, something that might seem to be a very simple thing. But when you talk about water coming in from outer space, what form is it in? And his comment was that if water is in the form of ice in the clouds, when it's, you know, building up snow, for example, in the cold wintertime, then in what form is water during that process, making snowflakes, etc.? And then out in outer space, you have no atmosphere at all. What form is water in that case? And so that's it's a good question. So I'm going to go into detail all the way from the time water is forming in the comet tail to the time it gets down on Earth. Also, water is coming into our atmosphere all the time. That's not just my theoretical work, but it was actually measured by Lou Frank, a scientist from the University of Iowa. And he put a kind of an interesting scientific story. He had made this proposal that water should be coming in to our upper atmosphere all the time. And nobody believed him. Nah, that can't be true. Space is a vacuum. There's nothing there. And so he had access to a satellite. He actually put an ultraviolet camera on the satellite. And when it went up into orbit, he had it hooked into the telemetry system and was able to extract that information coming back, and then was able to show everybody, hey, look, here are the pictures, the ultraviolet signatures of water coming into our atmosphere. But anyway, I'm not going to get into that yet. That's the main science topic. I'll be talking about water and what form it takes, and I think you'll find that very interesting. Okay, just a few updates. Be sure to watch the recent interviews that have been done by Judy Mokovich, her name is. And she had worked with Fauci and all these people. And she talks about how her work had been robbed, how she had been put in jail. And basically, her profession destroyed. And I can tell you from personal experience that that does happen. It happened to me. And then somebody took her work, changed it around, and then published it in the form that they wanted. There's a little story that is very public, but I'll repeat it here just for information for people who have possibly not heard it. When I was at Cornell, I'm a faculty member at the Cornell Physics Department, and later at the Cornell Mathematics Department, it was actually when I was in the Mathematics Department that I submitted a paper to the Icarus, which was the Space Science Journal of Cornell University, with Carl Sagan as editor. But Carl was on leave in Los Angeles doing the Cosmos series, so a guy named Joe Burns was in his place as editor of Icarus, the Space Science Journal of Cornell. So I submitted my paper there. It was, the title of the paper was Saturn's Sweeper Moons Predicted. And it showed the electrical effects that were obvious from distant observations of Saturn's rings, and that they indicated because of the plasma discharge comet model and the issue of how the comet's electric fields worked, that there should be fading in the Saturn's rings. So I'm not going to go into all the details. But at any rate, Joe Burns writes me back a letter because I had submitted this paper there to publish. I thought, well, I'm on Cornell campus. I may as well publish in the Cornell Journal. And so Joe Burns writes back and he says, no, there's nothing to this. There's no such thing. There's no reason. The standard theory of rings of Saturn, they've been around since the beginning of the solar system, and there's no reason to invoke this idea of Saturn's sweeper moons. So anyway, so he rejects my paper. Well, unbeknownst to him, I take my paper, and at that time I was talking to a guy named Hans Bethe. He's a Nobel Prize winner in physics from Cornell, an elderly gentleman, one of Albert Einstein's actual good friends from the time they were young. They came to the United States together during the whole issue of Germany there in World War II, etc. And Hans Bethe and Einstein come to the United States. And so anyway, Einstein ends up at Princeton and Hans Bethe ends up at Cornell. But, so anyway, I went to talk to Hans Bethe and he said, here, you send this article over to this European journal. And in fact, it got published. So my paper called Saturn Sweeper Moons gets published. And then Joe Burns takes my work, my title, which he said couldn't possibly exist, and publishes it himself, changing it around to suit his own needs, and then writes a book and becomes famous for the NASA expert on Saturn sweeper moons, because they were in fact discovered when the first Voyager spacecraft went out there. They were in fact discovered. They discovered all these little moons exactly as I predicted. But Joe Burns took credit. So believe me, I can tell you from personal experience that that happens. It does happen, and it's chronic. It's not just my case. It's not just Judy Mukovits's case. It's chronic in the sciences, and especially when you get up to those levels. So anyway, watch Judy Mukovits's recent interviews. She's got a trailer out for a movie that's coming out this summer called Plandemic. And so anyway, she's telling the story about corruption in the World Health Organization, all these other organizations in this, that Anthony Fauci was associated with. And I knew the first time I saw that guy poke his head up over the podium that he was a con man and one of these scientists. I've talked about him before. But okay, so I'm not going to dwell on that, but look at those movies of hers, those YouTube videos, and they keep moving around, so make sure you find them. There are other people I told you before to listen to, Andrew Kaufman, his interviews, and there are many more on the internet now that are coming out. Doctors are coming out of the woodwork all over the place saying how this whole thing was mismanaged. Recently, there was this whole coronavirus thing was mismanaged. Recently, there was one of my very first suggestions, let me just turn this around. One of my very first suggestions when this whole thing started was the issue of, it's called vectoring. When you have a pandemic like this or an epidemic that's potential, what you do is you isolate, you quarantine, and the method of doing this is called vectoring. You take the person who you've detected to have contracted this ailment, this issue, and you isolate them, and then you find everybody that they've been around for the last 2-3 weeks, whatever the latency period is, which was about 3 weeks for this coronavirus thing, and you have to find everybody that they potentially have been in contact with, and you do that right away. So when there were 4 cases in Washington State and 2 cases in Texas and 3 down in Southern California, that's when you do vectoring. And you can contain it, and this thing should have never gotten out of the box. But Fauci and this Burke woman, and these are in the White House. And I don't know what Trump is thinking there, but he's totally out of his element there with these people. These people are stupid or criminal or both. But anyway, you have to do the vectoring very early. So now that there have been potentially millions of people exposed, they come out and say, oh, well, now we got to do vectoring. So this moron governor of Kansas comes out and he provides an edict and he says, everybody that goes to church, we have to have all of their names and addresses and where they live and all their data, and that a church cannot open unless it takes all this information and sends it to me. And I'm thinking that, you know, take a stupid politician, a liberal left politician, to take a good idea and turn it into something draconian. You know, it's just absolutely bat crazy that people would try and do it after this thing has spread. No, vectoring is not effective once the cat's out of the box, once it's spread widely. And so, geez, I mean, this thing has been so mismanaged from the beginning. And it's not Trump's fault. He's just trying he's been doing what he should do, is get advisors to give him information. He's not a doctor, and neither would any other president that would be in his shoes. They're not doctors. They're not virologists. They're not, you know, laboratory technicians in viral technology. You know, so he needs to get information, and he's just got the wrong people giving him information. All they did in the beginning was say, oh, well, there's 20, today there's 50, now there's 100, now there's 200. And that doesn't do anything. That doesn't contain the problem. So it was totally mismanaged from the very beginning. Now, here's a story that you've probably seen. It hit the major news media. A young researcher, his name was Liu, that was his last name, and he was at a research position at the University of Pittsburgh, and killed in his apartment, and the killer supposedly committed suicide in his car out in front. Well, obviously, this is a setup of some kind. Who knows exactly the scenario, but you could think of 10 different scenarios, but it's a hit on this guy who's a researcher who was about to make a major announcement regarding coronavirus. So you could think about 20 things that he could potentially announce that somebody would want to shut him up. And so, of course, all his work disappears, just like when Robert Harrington from the Naval Observatory literally discovered Planet X as the nucleus of what eventually became Hale-Bopp. They snuffed him out. They killed him. They killed him. And, I mean, this has been going on for a long time. Just absolutely insane. But anyway, I don't want to talk too much about that. But there's one last story, and that is, oh, here's another story. By the way, it's becoming confirmed that the test kits have the coronavirus in it. So do not take a test. Because what they do is they stick it way up in your nose and they stick it back in the back of your mouth, and they're planting this coronavirus thing and potentially other things in your throat. There was a guy, I forget, was it Tanzania, the president of Tanzania or something, one country in Africa. And he's a very smart guy. He took the test kits that were sent to them. And they put fruit juice on it from a fruit plant. And they put other, like a goat's, they took a sample of snot from a goat and I don't know, some other stuff. And they sent it in with people's names on it, and they all came back positive. So the fruit supposedly had coronavirus, which, of course, tells you, number one, that either the test kits were contaminated with the coronavirus or the test is faulty or both. Probably both. But at any rate, no, this whole thing is turning into an absolute disaster. But the last thing that just came out starts to dribble out, and the news media is starting to dribble this out, is that all of a sudden they're saying, oh, there's another strain going around. Well, we already know that there was a different strain in Italy than there was in the U.S. and different than the South Korea strain, different than the China strain. All these different strains were different. And so somebody's going around and planting these. And this is exactly what I said would happen. As soon as they want to start opening up things again, somebody will go out and drop some what I call fairy dust into the public and infect them with potentially the same one or a new one or something. So this is, they're not going to let this go. The insane people that want to control the world are not going to let this go. They've got the world by the body part. Pick your body part. They've got the world by the body part. And, you know, they're not going to let go. They are not going to let this thing go. It's like a dog that's got an old shirt and he's like wrestling with it. They're not going to let go, because if they do, they're going to lose everything. Because, you know, the other thing that's coming out here is all of these little Hitler type people that are all over in government. These people are judges, they're in, you know, police positions, they're in all kinds of positions, especially at the local level. I said this before, that they have been working for decades to get these little Hitler-type people into these local positions so that when this popped, and this was very much planned, this whole thing was very much planned. So when it popped, that all of these little position, these little fiefdom monsters, these are the kind of people that when you were in grade school, you wanted to take them out and back and beat the crap out of them. That's the kind of person we're talking about here, because they're just jerks. They always were. They always will be. They got in a position of power, and now they're going to rule over everybody. Like this judge in Texas who convicted a hairstylist for cutting hair, $7,000 fine, and went straight to prison. When they're letting, you know, they're letting convicted felons and killers out of prison, and then they put this woman for cutting hair in prison. That's how nuts it's gotten. It's gotten absolutely nuts. But like I said, now they're coming out with, oh, doggone it, there's another strain going around. Yeah, they're not going to let this go. This is all man-made. This is contrived. Okay, so enough of that. I'm on other radio shows constantly, so listen to my interviews of John Moore every Wednesday morning. Next week I'll be on the Power Hour again on Wednesday. And so I was with Butch Power the other day, last Saturday, on his Bible study group, and I went through pretty much the whole hour myself there. Pastor Butch Powell, I think it's pastorbutch.com, I think is his web page, and that interview would be available there. So at any rate, okay, on to some other topics. On the positive side, Virgin Galactic, the Richard Branson funded entity that started out with Spaceship One back. They won the original X Prize and the Ansari X Prize for going into outer space a couple times in a week, and $10 million prize. That was the very first X Prize. And the X Prize I was involved in as a finalist won the 2018, or was awarded, you would say, the 2018 Technology Innovation Achievement Award from X Prize for my work on the wing generator and powering two of my atmospheric water generators. And so so winning an X Prize is kind of an exclusive group of people. But back to Virgin Galactic, they just had a successful test flight of their glider called Unity. And that's a kind of a catchy name. I like that name, Unity. And that it means like to unite or unity. But it also in mathematics, unity is like oneness. It's like it's related to one, unity. And so there's some very subtle meanings there, hidden meanings in that name. But that's the name of their spacecraft. But what they do is they take it up with the White Knight. The White Knight 2 is actually the bigger carrier vehicle. It takes off from a runway. They take it up to 50,000 feet, drop it off, and then this craft glides back down and lands on a runway. So they did a successful run there. They were saying they got up to Mach 0.7, which is 7/10 the speed of sound. And so that's moving right along. But anyway, the whole idea is then that they will take this spacecraft up to about 50,000 feet, drop it off, and it's got one big engine right in the tail end. And the idea is they kick that engine in, it does a burn, it goes all the way up into outer space, and then when it drops back in, it's kind of like when you were a kid, you shot an arrow up in the air, and the arrow would go up, and when it started coming down, the feathers would make the arrow come straight down. That's all it is. It's like a kind of like an arrow. And then they come back, and they glide to a landing. So a glided landing from a runway takeoff, and then so runway to runway, it's called a runway to space. And I'm sure that someday they'll have a vehicle that they can actually go into orbit, possibly a second stage. And it's Scaled Composites. I think they have a different name for the company now that's actually building the spacecraft. It's a subcontracted. I don't know all of the business arrangements or how they arrange the companies, but at any rate, congratulations to those people. Unfortunately, they then signed an agreement with NASA, because NASA's got nothing going on. If it weren't for Elon Musk and SpaceX, there would be nothing to announce in the space because NASA's got nothing going on. So NASA's got money, and anyway, the Richard Branson and the Virgin Galactic signed some kind of agreement with NASA, and I imagine that's a good business move because NASA's that's a funnel into the the federal government money tap, money machine. And so anyway, we'll see where that goes. But just stay on the private space program side of things. Congratulations. I'm always happy to see those kind of things going on. And that's where the real successes are. Let's see. I wanted to talk about my new product. I brought it up last week. It's the Grow Towers. And people are buying these. These are selling. And let me give you the price tag here, and you might choke at first. It's around $700 for a home kit grow tower, but it comes complete with the tank and the solution and the seeds and the grow tower and the pump and the timer and all the instructions and the liquid and the growth medium, everything you need to make this thing work. But here's the deal. Here's the deal. To become food independent. And these are amazing devices. Basically, it's called aeroponics. And so what happens is the container at the base contains water and the nutrients. And as explained by the scientists that developed this, the plant in dirt, what it does is it extracts the nutrients from the dirt. But basically, it doesn't need the dirt. It doesn't need all that sand and grit and other stuff. All it needs are the nutrients. So they isolate the nutrients, and it's in the water solution. And so what happens is the pump pumps the solution, the water, basically, with the nutrients up in a tube, and then it sprinkles down and it wets the roots of the plants, and you have many different plants in there. But what's interesting is, say you're growing lettuce. You got two or three lettuce plants, and in one particular hole, you might have up to seven lettuce plants growing. And then you have celery. You can have tomatoes. One of the great things, you can put a trellis around it and grow tomatoes. And so imagine having a tomato plant that's putting out tomatoes every day. So you're picking off tomatoes, and the way they say it, the more you pick, the more it's going to grow. So anyway, the same with the lettuce. You don't harvest the whole lettuce plant. You take clippings every day, and then it grows back. And so over the course of a couple of days, the lettuce is growing back. And so you're clipping off maybe four or five parts of lettuce to make a salad for the family. And then you come back in another day or so, and it's all grown back. And so it's like this bush that's growing either in your house, or you can have grow lights around it. They also come with lights, LED lighting, very efficient. And so you could have it like in a secluded area in your basement even, and have it as your growing area for your vegetables. So you can grow your herbs, vegetables, etc. Okay, so go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. Take a look at these. But then, number one, they take very little power, very, very little power. And so you can just plug it into a electric socket. And even if you had off-grid, and this is the thing, too, that people have to be conscious of. What if the electric goes out someday and you have an off-grid system? Well, you can run this unit off very little power. So your batteries would run an inverter. And you could power this thing. It's less than running a light bulb over the course of a day. So it'd be like running a light bulb for maybe an hour. That's all the power that it takes. But the here's the ticket. It reduces the growing time drastically. A head of lettuce typically takes around 78 to 90 days to grow a head of lettuce. With this, it's 21 days. And so it's a system that's really amazing. Then also the footprint. If you were going to grow 10 heads of lettuce, you would need a plot of ground pretty big. You'd need a couple square feet for every head of lettuce, maybe about three square feet. 2.5 feet by 2.5 feet for every head of lettuce. This, you're growing 10 heads of lettuce in a column that's about as big as one lettuce plant. So it's very economical. It's very clean. You can have it in your house. You can have it in your, a back window facing south or whatever. So you cut the grow time in third, and then also you can have it in a greenhouse. And I have commercial systems also available. So the commercial systems start at 10 towers with 44 plants in each tower, and that can grow from there. And so 10 towers is the minimal commercial system, and then it can get bigger from there. But the other issue is that you can buy these. There's actually a credit program. So when you pay for it, say that the unit is around, the home unit is about $700. And that comes with everything that you need. But you can pay for it in monthly, 12 monthly payments. So your credit card would be billed $60 every month for the next 12 months. And so I'm seeing that about two-thirds of the people are buying them that way. So you don't have to fork out the full $800 or $700 right up front. And so that's what I'd say, like two-thirds of the people that buy these are buying them in that way. And so your credit card would just be charged once a month, about $60. And once these things start producing, believe me, it'll pay for itself. And then after you pay for the thing, it's going to be basically free food almost. And you can go to a place, this unit comes with the seeds, but then after that you can go to a place like, there's many heirloom seed vendors on the market out there. Just go out and buy your heirloom seeds, non-GMO, organic. And I'll tell you something also, that if you buy something in a store that says organic, it's really not. It's they have so many ways of getting around being true organic. It's just pathetic. But if it's come across a state line, it's had something sprayed on it for bugs or fungicide or something like that. Anyway, I'm going to stop talking about this, but I'm really sold on this thing. It's really an amazing product. And so go to the webpage, once again, jmccsci.com. And also I want to recommend that people get a whole house water filter. People are starting to buy those. Let me tell you what the future is. Here is your future. You need to have some kind of supply of food. Did you know that right now we have farmers plowing under crops that are ready for harvest and market? They're shutting down food processing plants, everything from nuts and milk and meat. They're shutting these plants down because they're saying, oh, there's coronavirus. This is what they did in Russia to starve their own people. They cut the food sources, and then this is to control the people. And it's an insanity that has infiltrated the United States from outside. So I'm not going to go into the whole history of that, but you're going to need your own food, and you're going to need vegetables and things like fruits, the things that give you the different vitamins, tomatoes, and this grow tower is the deal. And then water filters, you better have water filtration. And so I'm the only person that's selling water filters right now. We're out of containers, but what I tell people is get yourself two. If you have a container for a water filter, good. Just buy the replacement filter elements from me. The factory is operating. We're filling orders. We're almost current on orders. The Imperials were a couple weeks out on filling orders, but we're doing very well. More people ordered the Imperials than the standard size filters, so that's why we're a bit behind on those. But the other thing is a whole house water filter, or if you need a container, you don't have a container, just go out and find yourself two food grade plastic containers that are the same size. And I'll tell you how to drill the holes so that you can put a single filter in the center. And I've been using those kind of things for years. It works great. You don't need stainless steel. Let me tell you, you're better off getting the couple food-grade plastic containers, drill the holes, buy a spigot kit and a pack of filters, and you got yourself a filter. When I travel, a lot of times, I only carry a filter element with me, because I know no matter where I go on the planet, I can find some containers where I can quick jerry-rig, put a couple holes in there, put the spigot in, and voila, you got a water filter. But what you need, the key element, is that water filter element. And I'm the only one selling any because everybody else, I don't care where you go, they're getting their water filter elements from China and India. One of the two, and I'm the only one that doesn't, that has the factory in the United States that's making these. So, and tell your friends. That's all I can tell you. So anyway, my webpage, I've also got the shipping containers and the wing generator. I'm not going to go into all of that. Just go to my webpage. And that's what I've been concentrating on, the things that you need to get through this mess that's coming down the road. They're not going to let this go, this coronavirus. This is act one of about a 10-act play, and it is not going to get any better. I can tell you that. Okay, on to the main science topic. And I love this topic. I love when listeners write in and ask a question. And when I used to be in the classroom, of which I was in the classroom a lot, I taught about 10 years university level physics, mathematics, computer science, and astronomy. Yes, I taught astronomy at the university level. And there was never a stupid question. And some students would say, well, you know, I was a little afraid to ask that question. I thought it was stupid. And you know what? If you're thinking it, probably 10 other people are thinking it too. Or maybe they didn't think about it, but they'd like to know what's going on with that topic. So basically, the best thing to do is just read the email from the listener, and then I'll go from there. Okay, let me see. I'm pulling this up here. Okay, it says, "Hi, Mr. McCanny. I've listened to your entire archive of free radio broadcasts, and you have never explained in what form the water enters the atmosphere and in what form it falls from the clouds. Very interesting. Is it liquid in all cases? You see, what I think about it is, especially in winter, how can water be liquid in the clouds? It's cold up there. I'm aware of the thermosphere and varying temperatures up there, if you can accept such information from standard science. But I'll bet most people don't even know that much. H2O, of course, the fantastic substance, a mystery in some aspects still. Your understanding of the state of the H2O and why so at each step from comet tail to upper Earth atmosphere to clouds, to descent toward the ground would be great knowledge for all of your audience, not just me. Sincerely," and then signed by the listener. So the question is, what about water? What kind of form is it in when it's up in the clouds, when it's making snow, when it's making hail, when it's making snowflakes? What's it like in outer space? Where does water really come from? How come we got water on the all over the Earth? Why is there salt water in the oceans but no salt in the Great Lakes or in the big lakes like in Central Russia, some of the big lakes? And then again, why are there some bodies of water that have extreme amounts of salt, like the Dead Sea, which has so much salt that nothing can live in it? And it's so salty that when you float, you're like halfway up out of the water. The buoyancy is incredible because of the salt content. And so anyway, the question is, what about this water stuff? Okay, so let me go out into outer space just for beginnings here. And it's well known that you encounter water in the tail of comets. Okay, so comets have water in the tails. And of course, scientists since the time of Kepler have believed that this comes off the nucleus. So what Kepler originally thought was that when these comet things come near the sun, and this is after they realized, Kepler was the first one that did the measurements. He took the Copernican measurements, Tycho Brahe's measurements, understood that these comets were way out there because Aristotelian science taught that the comets were up in the atmosphere. Aristotle taught that comets were fire up in the atmosphere. That's what they taught for, a couple thousand years until Kepler came along and said, nope, they're way out there. They're in their orbit around the sun. They're in elliptical orbits. And at the same time, a guy named Edmund Halley, came along, and he recognized that Halley's comet was a comet in an orbit. Then they looked back through history, and the 1400s biotapestry from England, Great Britain, showed the comet in the sky at exactly the right year, and they went back into the Chinese records and found it. About every 70 years, this comet comes through the solar system that Halley had discovered. So anyway, which, by the way, just the other night, there was a meteor stream due to Halley's comet. But anyway, so there's water in the tail of a comet. But how does it get there? What form is it in? And what I recognized in my research was that nothing comes off the nucleus. The water is coming in towards the nucleus under strong electrical forces. So here's literally where water gets its beginning. Because out in outer space, things are typically dissociated because of the ultraviolet light of the solar wind. And the solar wind, but primarily ultraviolet light, eventually dissociates atoms out there. So they're individual atoms. So you have carbon and nitrogen and oxygen and hydrogen and sulfur and etc. And so how do they combine? Like out by Jupiter, there's a lot of sulfur dioxide. And so it's almost a form of water. It's a kind of an interesting mix, but you have sulfur instead of hydrogen. And so in the realm of Jupiter, though, there's this same process is going on of combination. So let's take a comet. You have hydrogen and oxygen out there in free space in the solar system. And by the way, there's a great deal of hydrogen that's coming into the sun to power it on an ongoing basis. And that's part of my theoretical work, that the energy of the sun is up in its atmosphere, not down in its core. And that's a very provable from 10 different ways, very provable. It has been proven. Although standard science, in their ignorance and ignorant bliss, doesn't understand this and ignores all the real data. But anyway, okay, so you have a comet tail, you have hydrogen and oxygen coming in, and in the electric field, they combine. And let's look at a modern hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket engine. Those are in liquid form, they're separated, and then they bring them together into a chamber, and you don't need a spark or anything. You just bring those things together, and they give off a tremendous amount of heat. And so that's the main thrust engine on the space shuttle system. Back in the old days of the Saturn V, the upper stages were oxygen and hydrogen, liquid form. And the main thruster was kerosene and oxygen, liquid oxygen. And so anyway, but out in outer space, you just have the hydrogen and oxygen when they're brought into proximity, and you have these clouds coming in and mixing, they mix and they become... You would think in outer space everything is cold. No, they become extremely hot. So this is a very interesting aspect to the listener's question, is that when you look at a comet tail and you think, well, it's in outer space, this has got to be snow, it's got to be ice or something. No, it's extremely hot. It's like the jet engine or the burning hydrogen and oxygen coming out the nozzle of the space shuttle engines, main engines. That's how hot it is. And so these form, and then what happens is the water, there's two possibilities here, because it's ionized at that point. It's missing an electron or two. And so they're positively charged, so they're being drawn in towards the comet nucleus. But when they get into the region around the nucleus, there's a sea of electrons that's coming from the electrical discharge from the sun side, and so they become neutralized. So now what happens, they're neutral, they're no longer being affected by the electric field of the comet nucleus, and if the comet nucleus is too small, then these neutrals go bleeding out with the pressure of the solar wind, and spacecraft have actually measured those. They're called neutrals. And the unwary scientists at Goddard and JPL think that this is water coming off the nucleus, but it's not. It's coming from the nuclear region. When the the Rosetta mission went out to the comet 67P, they were looking for all this activity coming off the nucleus, and there wasn't any. And I talked to the lead scientist, this woman, Catherine, and I said, how close was the closest point you got to the nucleus where you actually measured water? She said it was about 10 kilometers away, and it got more dense. As they got out to 100 kilometers, the water got even more dense. But there wasn't a shred of water within 10 kilometers of the nucleus. And so they all realized that the dirty snowball comet model couldn't be correct. When they got in and actually looked at the nucleus and actually landed on it, there was no water, there was no ice, there was no snow, there's no dirty snowball. And they actually admitted on camera that that was the case. But the news media keeps calling it the dirty snowball comet model, just like they keep calling the coronavirus something to worry about. The same fake news media. That's all the same. Okay, so anyway, in outer space, water, when it forms in the comet tail, is extremely hot. And it's ionized. Okay, and so like Venus, which is a recent planet that formed from a large comet, is extremely hot. It's a baking, the surface of Venus is hot enough to melt lead, and it's got an atmosphere 1,000 times thicker than that of Earth's. And so the reason is that the gravitational field of Venus was sufficient to hold this material in gaseous form, and so thus it has this massive carbon dioxide atmosphere. So going back to the comet tail, not only do you see water, but you see other abundant species like carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, nitrogen-hydrogen compounds like ammonia. You see the carbon-hydrogen chains, which we call petroleum, or the ancients called naphtha. And so you see all of these chemicals forming in the comet tail. And so it would be like you took a chamber, just take a vacuum chamber and vaporize carbon and oxygen and nitrogen and hydrogen and sulfur and a whole raft of, in fact, iron, other atomic species, and put them in there and let them just mix. And what you're going to end up with, especially if you put an electric field in there or you put an electric current, you're going to end up with all these chemicals forming. They just form naturally. And so the latent heat of formation, something I worked on when I was in college, I took physical chemistry, and one of my projects was understanding the theoretical aspect of what are called potential energy curves. In other words, how much energy does it take to form a molecule? Whether it's water, whether it's in some of them, it doesn't take very much at all. Like water, they form readily. Other ones take a little bit more energy, but when you have these big clouds of stuff coming in and converging on the comet nucleus, there's a lot of collisions, there's a lot of interaction, and that's where these things form. And then there's other effects, because these streams of water coming in are ionized. And so you can see these. In fact, there are pictures. When Comet Hale-Bopp was up there, there was an astronomer in Florida who was taking pictures of these with something called a Swan filter. And you put the Swan filter on your camera, on your telescope, and what happens is it only looks at triply ionized oxygen and doubly ionized hydrogen. And so what you get is a very highly ionized water molecule. And these were coming in streamers. It looked like an octopus, we counted 17 different tails, and they were out there like snakes flailing around. But what happens is these currents are so strong, the electric currents, is that they, something called the pinch effects, that's the self-induced magnetic field of a large current, pulls that current together. And so that was the effect coming around Hale-Bopp. And NASA did everything it could to cover up that data and snuff out the information of that scientist. Once again, the absolute corrupt scientific industry in the United States. That's just another example. So just back to Judy Malkovich, was she Was she ostracized, had her life ruined, put in prison, and had her work stolen by other people? Yeah, that's not the exception. That's the rule in science. It's just absolutely corrupt, where these people are just protecting their little holy grails. They're, you know, the Anthony Faucis of the world, who are protecting their little fiefdoms and working for the corrupt pharmaceutical companies. Yeah, it just stinks. People being killed, scientists being killed over their research that would probably benefit you and mankind, and they're being killed in their apartment and then all their materials robbed and not published. Yeah, this is, it just stinks. I mean, it just stinks so bad that, anyway, back to, I should be talking about water here, but I can't get off these other topics of scientific just corruption. Okay, so now I've talked about chemical formation in comet tails and the fact that the big comets have enough gravitational field to hold this material, whereas the little comets don't, and that material becomes neutralized and blows away in the solar wind. And so then you have the electric field, the electric current coming from the sunward side, the electron electric current, baking the hydrocarbons and other forms of molecules onto the surface of the comet. And that's why the comet surface looks like tar in a lot of cases, or in the case of Comet 67P, you had a fine grain of organic molecules, carbon, nitrogen, hydrogen, oxygen, molecules formed on the surface, kind of a dust. And that's what they discovered there. There was no water, no ice, no snow, nothing coming off the nucleus, but they still call it a dirty snowball. You know, absolute corruption in science. Okay, now let's look at what Lou Frank discovered. What he discovered was water coming into the Earth's upper atmosphere. And I've given examples of this on a large scale, where we have, a solar storm, the Earth interacts with it, Earth is always acting like a comet, drawing in material from the outer regions of the beyond our Earth and the solar system, and so water is one of the primary ones. Water is, there's no accident that Mars and Earth are water planets. Mars had its water removed a couple thousand years ago. The ancients saw it. It was a blue planet. And then this large comet Venus came by and sucked it all off. That's what the ancients tell us. You can see all of the trademarks of that on the surface of Mars. Okay, so Earth's upper atmosphere is bringing in, and I have actual pictures drawn of this. It looks like if you've ever seen a leech attached to the side of a fish, where it's like grabbed onto the side of a fish, that's what these things look like. And so they're plasma extensions coming out of our upper atmosphere, where water is draining down in to the upper atmosphere. And once there was a tremendous storm, was a rainstorm that hit Duluth, Minnesota. And I remember studying this particular storm because it formed out of nowhere. And the only way that water could form in that quantity coming in, and it came in across western Minnesota, I mean, the closest body of water is the Pacific Ocean or the Gulf of Mexico. And there was absolutely no water coming into this location from either of those sources. And so all of a sudden it formed and it moved easterly up through north central Minnesota towards Duluth. By the time it got to Duluth, it dumped, I can't remember, something like 12 inches like in an hour. Just that was washing cars down the street. It was destroyed the sewer system. Anything that was not nailed down got washed down into Lake Superior, because Duluth is a city of very steep hills. It's like San Francisco, very steep hills. Everything washing down into the water down below. In the case of San Francisco, it's the San Francisco Bay or the Pacific Ocean. In the case of Duluth, it's down into Lake Superior. So anyway, there was a massive amount of water that just came out of nowhere. And it's like, where did this water come from? So it turned out that there was a spigot, you might call, a natural flowing influx of water from outer space. That's where the water came from. And it's constantly coming in, usually at a very low rate. and constantly building up. But then people say, well, what happens to all this water? And what the answer is there's a hydrological cycle, which when it rains and drops the rain, and then when that evaporates and comes up in the atmosphere, there's a rotational force, because the Earth is rotating, where that water tends to move northwards every time it cycles, and it ends up at the North and South Pole. That's what happens to it. So the North and South Pole are continually building up, contrary to global climate change alarmists who would tell you that they're melting away. No, they're building up vertically. So you don't take an area of these ice masses. You have to take the vertical extent. And I'll just tell you a little story here. Back in the, it was about probably 30 years ago now, a group of pilots from World War II were flying it was back post-World War II. They were flying some World War II vintage aircraft up by the North Pole, and they were forced to land. So they had a forced landing. They sent some airplanes in, got them out. And this is about 20 years ago, so maybe about 30, 35 years after they had abandoned these aircraft. They said, hey, this is all fair game. Let's go up and grab these airplanes. They're full of gas. All we got to do is start them up and bring them back. So they go up to the exact spot where the airplanes, where they had landed the airplanes on the ice pack, and there's nothing there. So they go, well, you know, what happened to them? They disappeared. So they start digging, and they found them like 100 feet down. They found the airplanes. So this whole time it had been building up and building up. And so that's how much buildup there is at the poles due to this hydrological cycle. So anyway, getting back to the water coming into the atmosphere. So when the water came in, it was in hydrogen, oxygen, atomic form. It eventually, as it comes into the atmosphere, these molecules, these atoms are meeting and forming the molecules of water. And so then they funnel down through the atmosphere. Typically, it's not this massive rainstorm like what happened at Duluth. But at that point, you're dealing with water in its molecular form, in a gas, literally in a gaseous form. So then when it comes down through the atmosphere, it starts to accumulate. And that's where you get into the troposphere. You get down farther into the cloud region of Earth, and they start to coagulate into droplets. Now, let's look at two scenarios. One where it's rain, where it's warm enough, they condense into droplets from the air, so it goes, because of the pressure change and the temperature change, it goes from a molecular form into droplets, and then the droplets accumulate, and when they become big enough, the air can no longer hold them, and they fall out as in the form of rain. But if it's cold, then the water is, once again, it's initially in atomic molecular form. It's like water molecules, individual in the atmosphere, and that's literally a vapor form of water. It's a gaseous form. But when the, part of my work with the prime numbers was dealing with how snowflakes form, because they're six-sided entities. So you have the center plus six is seven, that's a prime number. And then when you look at the way they expand, if you want to look at this, look at my Calculate Primes book, I've got a chapter on this. But you need an electric field for the snowflake to form. And that's something that's well proven also in the laboratory. Okay, so what happens? So the molecular water is building up on this six-sided crystal that has an electric field, and there's a reverberation that comes, electronic signaling that comes through from the very center. In the very center of the snowflake is a little piece of dust. And so that acts like a reflector, and so all six, ever wonder why a snowflake has perfect symmetry, six-sided symmetry, or six-way symmetry? It's because of the electric field emanating out, and it's because of the properties of water. So crystalline water in a gaseous form has a six-sided symmetry, and that's what a snowflake is. And so what's happening is you're going from the molecular form directly into the crystalline form, which is a solid. And so, for example, there are other types of crystals that build up in the same way, because water in that state forms a crystal. And there's a whole thermodynamic study of crystals just in its own right. And then when the snow gets, once again, too heavy for the air to hold, it falls out, and that's what we call snow. Okay, and once again, you can also see this, for example, on the planet Pluto. When the New Horizons spacecraft got to Pluto, the influx, which is coming in from a comet tail, was nitrogen-hydrogen compounds, ammonia and other nitrogen-hydrogen compounds. And it came floating in, and you could see the snow. You could literally see the snow, the nitrogen-hydrogen ammonia snow coming into the planet Pluto. Okay, so anyway, a little bit of chatter there about molecular structure in the atmosphere under cold conditions, under warm conditions. Where does it come from? Possibly a few surprises there for people. But these are things that I know myself, and the fine details that potentially are not out in my work, in my published work, but I'm glad when people ask these questions, because it gives me a chance to go off into some of these more esoteric aspects of my work. Okay, so I could go on and on about other types of molecules. The ancients talked about the hydrocarbons, what they called naphtha, coming into the atmosphere. And there again, Earth was acting as a comet, or we were in a comet tail. The Noah's flood was 40 days and 40 nights of torrential rain because we were passing through the tail of a large comet. In the Moses event, which was thousands of years later, this is the Venus event, the one Velikovsky talks about, the ancients talked about the brimstone and fire. The brimstone was the meteor stream, this fine dust that was accompanying the meteor stream, accompanying the comet. And as the hydrocarbons came into the atmosphere and met the oxygen that's already in our atmosphere, and then the meteors were coming in, it ignited the naphtha. So it was burning when it came in. It was like raining burning tar, basically, with little pebbles raining in on these people. And they talk about how it burnt their skin. And we know this is true because we see it in the mastodons. We see the remnants of animals with these types of scars. So it's an actual true story verified by scientific study. Okay, so I got about 20 seconds left here. Remember my webpage, the tower, the grow towers. Go there, get those. And $700 is not a big price to pay for vegetables over a long term, years and years of use. So go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.